Customers are rushing to your store. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. Shopify POS is your command center for your retail store. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify has everything you need to sell in person. With Shopify, you get a powerhouse selling partner that effortlessly unites your in-person and online sales into the one source of truth. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock. Connect with customers in line and online. Shopify helps you drive store traffic with plug-and-play tools built for marketing campaigns from TikTok to Instagram and beyond. Get hardware that fits your business, take payments by smartphone, transform your tablet into a point-of-sale system, or use Shopify's POS Go mobile device for a battle-tested solution. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/theathletic, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/theathletic to take your retail business to the next level today. shopify.com/theathletic.
The Athletic.
Hello and welcome to the latest episode of the Race IndyCar podcast. Jay Hildebrand back alongside me this week. He's had two episodes off. We all know where he's been. He's been on the publicity tour for John Wick 4, which has recently released. And now we've got him back to do his proper job of co-hosting the Race IndyCar podcast. How are you doing, Jay?
I'm good, man. I'm great.
There's a lot going on at home. You shared on social media that you've welcomed a new child into the world. So, yeah, we were just discussing that you are sleeping. So that's.
I have been getting some sleep. My wife, slightly less so. But we've got my wife's a postpartum, like, mom baby nurse. So I feel like our entire experience has been, like, total VIP. Just from it'd be like going to the Indy 500 with me, probably, like. You just kind of know everybody, you know all the nurses, you know all the doctors, all the lactation consultants, everything there is to know. Not to mention having an absolute expert running the show in the household. So yeah, it's been an awesome experience. Little Julietta came on a couple weeks ago, or a week ago this past Saturday on the 25th. And we're super excited. So it's been it's definitely a new chapter that we're looking forward to.
I wish I had a nurse with me in Texas to look after me after being kicked in the face in a brutal football accident. I shouldn't use the word accident because I'm pretty sure there was malice involved, because I'm 6'2". So in order for someone to kick me in the face,
takes some effort.
That's some gymnastic stuff going on there. So maybe I'll call him out at the end of the podcast and just put him on wax, let him know I'm coming for him. Later in the year.
That's what podcasts are for.
Exactly. Our podcasts are also to talk about brilliant motor races. So let's get into Texas, because it was absolutely fantastic to watch. I'm really glad I chose this year as my first year to head to Texas and to this race in particular, and get a bit of a taste of a different super speedway to Indy. Very, very different style in many ways, but the speed is obviously there. The spectacle is there. Yeah, absolutely fantastic experience to see the cars there. Definitely recommend anyone who's not been to Texas before to go and check it out. And I'm sure you would back that up from someone who's sat behind the steering wheel, JR. The race was dominated by Joseph Newgarden and Pato O'Ward, really. Even if they weren't always leading the race, they always felt like they were coming, or they were going to be the ones who were going to be there at the end. Obviously, Pato had that stint in the middle of the race where he was able to lap everyone apart from Joseph Newgarden, which was very impressive. And that coincided with Joseph maybe taking a bit of an incorrect setup direction, where he had a bit of understeer in that middle part of the race. So he was 2 seconds up on Pato, lost that 2 seconds, and then lost another 7 seconds to Pato as he drove off into the distance before a host of cautions muddied the waters at the end of the race there and gave all of the fans a spectacular finish to the race, until a caution came out right at the end. And that's ultimately what decided the race for Joseph Newgarden. I guess in these situations, Joe, we've talked about it lots on the podcast before in similar races. How did you feel about how the race ended? Do you feel like we were robbed of that kind of last lap battle between Pato and Joseph? Or are you kind of happy that, you know, the rules played out as they should do here, and that this is one of those things where, you know, we kind of got the end of the race that we deserved?
Yeah, I think that my general opinion watching these types of races over the years, but again, in this particular situation, is I think what actually adds to a lot of the drama over that last 10 lap stint, or from 10 to go, let's say, is that a caution at any point probably ends the race. And so you get really, there's not a lot of jockeying for position into the last lap. You know, you're not really planning for the final lap. Basically, you're not planning for how you're going to make a pass on the final lap. And this is back to, I mean, the last time I can, you've had a Texas race here and there over the last 10 years, Fontana race. You know, there was sort of one Fontana race, I think 2016-ish or something, that was kind of like this in the aero kit era, where the cars were loaded up with downforce. But this is really back to, it's worth remembering back to when there was a lot of mile and a halves on the schedule, kind of the latter part of the IRL era, which was the very beginning of my career. I basically had 1 year in that car where we ran 4 or 5 mile and a halves that season in 2011. That this was kind of how all of those races were, that it wasn't necessarily 3 or 5 wide. It wasn't this kind of insane, you know, it was usually you could run 2 wide. Cars were fast enough. They had just enough grip that was doable. And probably those first 2 cars were running laps flat, just kind of jockeying for the right draft and side draft off the rear quarter, and, you know, trying to get the right run at the right distance around the lap or whatever. But rarely were the, when we used to run it, even in those days running at Texas, but when we used to run at Kansas and Kentucky and, you know, those kinds of places, they looked a lot like this, that even if a third lane was usable, like even if it, you know, we never struggled with PJ1 or any of these kind of resins or any of that kind of stuff. But usually just because of the nature of the benefit to being low as opposed to high on a track that's this distance, you're running a lot more distance to run up in a third lane. If the cars that are in the first and second lane can run flat out, you're just not going to get anywhere basically running that much extra distance around the lap. So I say all of that sort of to say that what made a lot of those races great also was the fact that you oftentimes had 2 cars side by side for a number of laps in a row. And it was kind of just going to come down to when a caution fell. That happened a lot. And those are still races that we sort of remember. And I think that that's, to me, a lot of what made this exciting at the end, was that all of those guys knew that there was, once you got inside of 5 to go, you're just racing for the win at every moment. Basically, you're trying to get to the lead, and there's frankly not a lot of value to there's too many cars running up front basically to try to back off to get a run or do any of that kind of stuff. You're just forced almost to pick a lane, you know, bottom lane 1 or lane 2, and try to start working your tools and doing everything you can to make the best out of that situation in those circumstances. So I thought it was really cool to watch. It's interesting, I think, to think about the circumstances that were required in order to have that. You know, this was, for a long part of this race, this looked like it was going to be Pato and Joseph just completely destroying everybody. You know, if that middle stint had gone longer into the third stint, then what ended up happening doesn't go down, right? And so despite the fact that they've changed the track and they added downforce with these different bits and pieces and all that kind of stuff, this was a unique set of circumstances actually that did create for this to happen. Like, this is definitely not a scenario where you can say, oh, we've solved this problem for Texas and we're going to have great races there from now on with this package, because it wasn't that race for a lot of the race. You basically just ended up in a situation at the end where, interestingly, because there were so few cars that were on the lead lap, you had a maximum at any time over those last cautions of like 8 cars that were ever on the lead lap, basically 8 or 9 cars, that when you only have that many cars in the lead lap, then it completely takes away the risk, or it mostly takes away the risk for those eight cars to pit for tires at any time, basically. And so you ended up with this kind of the perfect storm of enough cars on the lead lap that it was a race, not so many cars in the lead lap that there becomes track position risk to pitting for tires, and that every one of those stops, at least one of those lead lap cars stayed out. So you never get a whole gaggle of other cars getting back onto the lead lap. So you basically had all of those cautions through, we'll call it the third stint, right? Like the, just the whole end of the race, the last, you know, 50 or 60 laps or whatever, that you had this cycle of at least somebody staying out. So you never invited more cars than were on the lead lap back to the lead lap. And it ended up creating for, and so then at that point, the fact that the cars had enough extra downforce compared to years past that enabled these guys to be running flat out, you know, two rows deep, side by side, two lanes wide, that really, you know, it made for what to me ended up being a surprisingly great whole final stanza of the event after what we had watched prior to that.
Yeah, you mentioned all of those circumstances coming together, JR. I guess we should kind of briefly just go back through those for anyone who's kind of tuning in, having watched the Texas race, but a bit unsure as to how that kind of whole thing came about there. So we had none of the PJ1 that you mentioned, which is the, I guess, one of the additions that NASCAR has tried to improve its racing, but it's been really detrimental to IndyCar. It's made running that high line really difficult in the past few years. So there was no extra PJ1. It was a different resin that was laid down last November. So that definitely made a difference to the track. It looked visibly less darker, which was good. It obviously did its job in that sense. So that was the first part of the equation. We also had IndyCar bring in various different aerodynamic parts, and it just so turned out that these three parts were basically run by all the teams all weekend as soon as they put them on, just because they were just so clean. They didn't, you know, create dirty air, but just added a load of downforce. So they were just like the perfect parts to put on. So we had the sidewall, the kind of longer sidewall that goes behind the rear wheel. We had the wicker, it's called, I guess. It's like a part that goes in the hole in front of the side pod, and then the barge board wings that were introduced at Indy last year that were underneath the car, and all three of those parts, it just turned out there wasn't really much need for experimentation for the teams. It was just bolt these parts on, it's going to make you faster and everything's going to work out well. So that was another good addition from IndyCar in that sense, that worked out well. We also had the Highline practice that was kind of trialed last year with I think it was it seven or nine cars? It was one of the two. I don't think all of the cars that did that practice really committed to the idea of it and ran the high line for the whole practice. And this year we got the whole field running in a high line, and a kind of off the record, unwritten threat that the drivers needed to take it seriously and run that high line. So we got a really serious approach to that as well. So I guess all of those factors coming together, some of them controlled by IndyCar and Texas, and some of them maybe a little bit fortunate in a sense the way it worked out at the weekend, but definitely created a really interesting race. One of the incidents I kind of wanted to get into with JR, just like from a chronological point of view, I guess it was one of the first things that happened in the race, was the Kyle Kirkwood and Alexander Rossi crashing in the pits there, because I guess the two commentators in the booth, Townsend Bell and James Hinchcliffe, kind of immediately jumped on Kyle for that. And I have to admit, watching it, I really thought Kyle was to blame for that incident as well. But since, you know, IndyCar have clarified the rules that the driver in the fast lane, that they call it, the far right lane, has precedent over any other driver, which includes any, you know, drivers in the pit. So it's up to Aaron McLaren to not release Rossi into Kirkwood, basically. But if you go back and watch the onboard of this happening, Rossi's already out of his pit box by the time Kirkwood turns into his box. So while the rules may have been followed to the letter of the law and correctly, in my opinion, this was a really, you know, unfair penalty, which has also been changed after the race by IndyCar. It's from an unsafe release to a unavoidable contact, I think, is the rule that they've gone with. So to reassess a penalty after a race is just a bit odd anyway. But yeah, I think maybe this is something that he's looking at, because while it's not Kyle's fault because he's kind of following the rules, it's also not really Alexander or McLaren's fault in that sense either. And I just think in these pit stops, the person who is ultimately responsible for releasing Rossi has to identify the car that is on the outside lane, work out who it is to start with, who is that driver, then know where they are in the pits in terms of where their pit box is. Have they pitted yet or have they not? Are they a threat or not? And then decide whether to release your driver. And you've got to do all of that in the space of, you know, less than a second. So I think that's something that probably will be and does need to be, you know, looked at in the future. How can we avoid a similar scenario like that? Because someone's been penalized there for something that probably wasn't their fault.
Yeah, I think that there's a couple of things that are going on here that just are, I guess, maybe idiosyncratic components of this whole thing. One is I tended to agree with Hinch's point of view on this whole thing when he was describing it because of a lot of what you're talking about, which is like, how is the guy sending Rossi supposed to know? Like, it's not really in his purview to know that he's just supposed to be looking for cars that he thinks that his guy is going to run into. And so you're looking for cars that are currently slowing down or diving into their pit box, which, to your point, you can see from kind of the synced onboards and all that kind of stuff that Kirkwood had not yet even made the turn into, maybe he had started to slow down, but he certainly had not made the turn into his pit box. And I would say that from a driver's perspective, you do typically, you're sort of taught in these situations to not start slowing down or really bending into your pit box until you've at least started to peel out of, move from the fast lane to the transition lane. So move from the lane that's furthest to the right on the outside to the lane that's sort of in the middle, transitioning into the pit boxes. And so, I mean, at Indy, you think Indy is an even tighter pit lane than Texas is. You know, that's just kind of the common, you know, the car, if you're in line coming into the pits, the car in front of you usually is out of your way before it starts to slow down. Then you're kind of making this movement to slow down and then bending in from the transition lane into your pit box. The only thing that I would say that is a little caveat or kind of a little wrinkle in this particular situation for Kirkwood is that there were a lot of cars coming into the transition lane that had pitted already that are kind of a threat to occupy the transition lane. And so I think I'm guessing that that was a part of his mindset for not going to the transition lane sooner, was basically just there's a lot of cars coming out of the pits that he's going to sort of end up getting past if he stays in the fast lane. If he's in the transition lane, he's just at a higher risk of having to stop or slow down or be in somebody's way or whatever. Ultimately, I think this just needs to be looked at overall to kind of establish what. So if you're penalizing Rossi and his guys, that's setting, I think, a weird precedent going forward for the teams having to be, as you said, and laid out very clearly, like, so the teams are supposed to know exactly who's coming into the pits and where those pits are and all that kind of stuff. That up until this point has been way outside the purview of what a right front tire changer, you know, crew chief oftentimes is tasked with looking for or being aware of. It's one thing when you're at Indianapolis and you've got days worth of practice where it's the same cars that are all around you. I mean, for an event like this, that's just not really how it is. You know, you're not getting that sight picture. You're not looking for those cars over the course of the event. So, I mean, I think an easier adjustment here to make would be really drive home that you need to be in the transition lane before you turn into your pit box, and that, you know, put that kind of fault on the driver, because the driver, as you're coming down the pit lane, you're the one that's looking ahead and can see all of the cars that are up there. So I don't know. I mean, there's some elements, like if you made that the hard rule, there are some elements of that that become a little bit tricky. If you're, you know, I'm not 100% sure that I'd feel good about saying the right of way is then in some sense to the cars that are exiting their pit boxes. But I think we at least need to enforce that the drivers that are coming into their boxes are sort of signaling that in advance, so that at least the teams that are a couple of pit boxes around them for sure do know that that's that car, and they can expect that they need to hold their guy for a second. So I guess I generally feel like the penalty was harsh on it. It didn't end up making any difference, but I felt like Kirkwood was kind of, if there was somebody that was really in the wrong, certainly from a driving perspective, in terms of like avoidable contact, it was Kirkwood for not being in the transition lane. Like that's the easy solution to this is if Kirkwood's in the transition lane, this probably doesn't happen.
Looking for an assist with your credit card, but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
All right, Jay, just to finish on the Kirkwood Rossi incident as well, I think, yeah, I might get jumped on a little bit for this, but I find it difficult not to have preference with the person who's in the top five fighting at the front of the race. To like the only thought in Rossi's mind or any of his team there is to stay in the top five and, you know, stay on course to try and win the race. Like that is the position he's in, and Kirkwood is obviously not in that position given the fact that he's entering his pit box as Rossi's leaving his. So while I don't want to see someone like Kirkwood have to slow down there and potentially give up a lap or lose ground themselves, I think that unless there's a significant element of incompetence or error in the release of the driver coming from the pit box, then the person in the top five has to have some sort of understanding that he is getting preference in the pit lane there, because he is a driver who is fighting for the lead of the race, basically.
I think maybe a slightly different riff on that, but in the same general, you know, sort of with the same general point of view, is basically just, I mean, I can tell you from experience, I've been in races where you're among those guys that are pitting first and you're kind of in the gaggle of cars that's going to be exiting the pit lane, exiting your box while there's cars that are maybe coming in. And I've certainly been on the other side of that in these kind of situations also. When you are further back, I guess I think generally, maybe this is just something that comes with a little bit of experience, that you do tend to just respect the little bit of etiquette there, which is, okay, look, like, I do. It is kind of my job to. It's not your job. It's not your responsibility. But I don't know. I have always felt in the car, if I'm not really a real dog in the fight, I'm gonna shave a little off of my maximum in those exchanges to make sure that I'm not responsible for getting in the way of those guys or screwing up their races. You know, it's kind of, you know, we've had this conversation about, you know, etiquette with like lapped cars or cars that are about to go a lap down at the end of races. And it's kind of like, I feel like there was a time when if Scott Dixon is ever in that situation, he just pulls over and lets guys go by. Like, you know, and so if that's what those guys do if the veterans in the field typically are guys that are going to give a little to just kind of stay out of everybody's way or to make sure that they're not accidentally or or in some borderline way responsible for screwing up somebody else's race when they are genuinely like battling at the front of the field, then I think that it's, I think it's fair to feel like that should sort of be how everybody should migrate towards operating in that same way. And that we'd probably just have fewer of these incidents. And it doesn't really, you know, when you're running 15th or 18th or whatever, it just doesn't change your race that much to give up a spot here and there. Like the difference between coming out of the pits in fourth versus seventh does change your race. The difference between coming out of the pits in 14th versus 17th just kind of doesn't. So I'm with you. So, I mean, you know, obviously we've got those two guys running up front. Pato was just totally in control of this race for a long period of time. And we know we kind of heard afterwards and you could see it. I guess I was not totally clear that they had made an adjustment to Newgarden that made for a change, but you could certainly see that he lost pace relative to Pato. So whether it was, sometimes that can be track condition changing just enough that it suits one car versus another, one setup versus another. I felt like Pato, definitely watching him throughout the race, he just always looked, as he's looked here in the past, the car just looked more positive in general. And we know that he's a guy from when he won this race, I guess a couple of years ago, I remember talking about it on the pod that it just felt like you needed to, in that race in particular, it was a lower downforce event. It was more like kind of how the middle of this race was just all the way through the end of the race. There was not that many cars in the lead lap. He kind of ran away with it towards the end, that you really needed the car to be able to be positive to exit the corner to get the runoff. He seemed like maybe at that point in time, he was just one of the only guys that was really willing to commit to the car being driven in that way, kind of at the limit of, you know, what the rear was going to give you. And he just sort of drove through it. He's certainly a guy that's expressed a high tolerance for doing that over the years. Ultimately, they sort of reconciled Newgarden's setup. And then we were on new tires more frequently at the end of the race. So that just takes away a little bit of whatever edge was going to exist for anybody over the course of a long stint. He ends up coming in second, a race that I'm sure he felt in control of at points. Coming off of St. Pete, where I'm sure he felt the same way, had something that was totally out of his control, Plenum Fire, take the win away. I don't think Marcus was going to get by him had that not happened. What do you think is his mindset at this point? You were there, so you maybe got a sense of it in person. I think I know how I'd be feeling a few days later now, but what do you get from Pato's vibe and where he's at? He's the points leader, so he's got that going for him. But I mean, at this point, he's probably sitting there like he could be the points leader by a much heftier margin had some things just fallen his way, no fault of his own.
Yeah, I managed to grab him after the race and we avoided a ton of Mexican fans who were trying to get selfies with him and almost got ran over by his car, funnily enough, that was waiting to go through tech as well, which is quite entertaining. So that was a fun interview. But yeah, I guess it's a really interesting situation for the reasons that you mentioned, that he's basically had two wins kind of, if not taken away from him, then he definitely had reason to believe that he was going to win those two races at one point. So most drivers would treat that with a level of negativity and upset for obvious reasons that, as you mentioned, you know, quite a few points have gone there. You know, we could be looking at a driver who has won the first two races of the season and is, you know, quite a way ahead in the points already. So it's definitely an interesting scenario. But I think Pato's maybe coming at it from a totally different perspective of, we've not always had the best starts to a season. And certainly in the context of last season, where behind the scenes at this point, there was major disagreement over whether he was even going to race for the team into the future without that new contract coming. And, you know, believing in himself that he deserved a certain level of contract and that he deserved to be, you know, one of the top drivers in the series, and struggling to get that over the line and to get that vindication, I guess, that he was in that class of driver. And I think he's proven that now by, you only have to look at the end of the year who's, you know, fighting for the championship, and, you know, he's almost always there or thereabouts. And if he isn't, there's usually good reasons for it that aren't, you know, to do with him. So I think there's a definitely a feeling of discontent that the races haven't gone his way, but also a feeling of internal jubilation that even with this, you know, kind of negativity surrounding the two races, that he's leading the championship and has begun a year in a way that he feels he can and deserves to, you know, start at some point, having had some difficulty in the past where he's been trying to get his, you know, championship bids off the ground early on. So really, really interested talking to him, because we know he's kind of an upbeat guy anyway. He's, you know, never wants to shy away from a joke. He's really outgoing on social media for people who follow him there, and get to see that kind of, I guess, an insight into his life that we maybe don't get with other drivers, because he's so outgoing and willing to share that, you know, aspect of his life with his fans. But you definitely can't mistake that for a lack of determination and sincerity in how he goes about his business. And I think we've seen that with his oval form is, you know, absolutely spectacular now coming into the series. And he never watched oval racing growing up, or had a particular, you know, affinity for it before he came into the series. And even in junior formula, he didn't do that many oval races in the junior formula before he came into IndyCar. So he's taken this challenge of learning something totally new, as a kind of personal one that he wants to conquer and believes that he can. So, really interesting kind of situation we're finding ourselves in here, with Pato having so much go against him, but so much go for him at the same time.
Yeah, I think the only thing that I would add is just from a driver's mindset, one of the things not going exactly your way is something that's frustrating when it's happening. But these types of races, certainly Texas, but even looking back at St. Pete, it was not accidental that Pato was in a position to win both of those races. And I think particularly an event like Texas, where, I mean, he ended up coming in second. It wasn't like he, you know, got taken out or ended up, you know, finishing way at the back somewhere. He had an entire stint of the race where he was just absolutely putting a beat down on literally everybody, every other car. He lapping Scott Dixon, this is not circumstantial somehow that this is going on. That feeling is usually the thing that actually hangs with you the longest from those types of situations, like remembering that you were that good at that race for a long period of time. And a guy like Pato has shown, along with a lot of the other, we talk about this with a lot of the guys that are up at the front of the field, that they're able to put the things that really weren't in their control or kind of didn't quite go their way or whatever, out of sight, out of mind pretty quickly. And so I think ultimately Pato, whatever his demeanor might have been post-race or whatever at either of these events, the thing that these are just serving to build more confidence in him that as long as he just does his thing, that this weird stuff is going to happen. It's going to happen less frequently on average than it has to start this season. And he could look at the second half of last season and basically say the same thing. You know, I still think about Mid-Ohio and, you know, there's some events that were just like, I just got totally stripped of a race where, and in those cases, it was like a major points deficit. You know, at least here he's finishing second in both of these scenarios. So yeah, I think Pato is definitely showing that he's one to be reckoned with. And if I'm him, I'm feeling ultra confident going into the next round of races, going into Indy, especially after the year that they had last year. If they can just find a little bit, if Chevy can just find a little bit, you know, they're not that far away. So, he's definitely sticking his flag in the ground here at the beginning of the year to show that they're very legitimate title contenders for the rest of the season.
Yeah, he's had 16 oval starts in IndyCar now, and his average finish is 4.69. So that just kind of speaks for itself.
That is a crazy stat.
It's almost beyond belief, isn't it? It's pretty spectacular. So we'll definitely be keeping an eye on him as we get towards the month of May, and whether Chevrolet can make that step forward that they were maybe lacking slightly last year in their pursuit of Ganassi. So that'll definitely be a storyline we'll be watching for the first part of the year here. I don't want to leave the topic of the kind of fight for the win without addressing Joseph. And this is the second win at Texas in a row, and the second win at Texas in a row with a new engineer. So Luke Mason on board and getting his first win with Joseph. I think he was asked about this in the post-race press conference, and he's thrilled even more so than last year, for sure, at the group of people that he has around him this year. And I think there's a genuine difference this year, in the sense that he just seems that bit more comfortable in the people around him, and not just necessarily the people around him. I think there's always an element of, you know, belief on Joseph's side that he's got the right people around him. You know, he drives a team Penske, and, you know, no one gets the position to be working on Joseph Newgarden's car if they don't, you know, deserve to be there in some way, shape or form. But I think last year there was definitely from the outside at least, a feeling that there was a lot of people there who were either making their debut on Joseph's car or in IndyCar itself, and maybe weren't ready to match, you know, what Joseph brings to the table. And that's obviously experience and a lot of success over a long period of time. So you can't always expect people to come in and just perform at Joseph's level, because, you know, that takes away from the level that Joseph's at. But I think what we're seeing this year to start the season, even though they had the issue in St. Pete with the engine fighter, that Joseph just has total belief that this team's ready to go on a tear this year and do something cool. So that was quite a scary proposition in the press conference, listening to Joseph talk that way.
Yeah, I can imagine. I mean, I think that I can say, obviously, Joseph and I are buddies. Like I was actually texting with him, just asking a few questions after Saturday, just to kind of get a feel for where his head was at after the practice sessions and all that kind of stuff. He anticipated an event that was probably more like the end of the race actually ended up being. He was confident that that second lane was going to work, and it was going to work in one and two and three and four. And the cars definitely had more downforce, as long as it wasn't super hot, that those things were all going to. So they were definitely ready for what they were going to be up against, or what they ended up experiencing the following day. But yeah, you definitely just get a sense that he's, you know, different drivers, the relationship between driver and engineer, even if it's not the person who's on your radio. You know, we talked last year about, you know, Pato and Taylor Kyle and, you know, some of those types of relationships, like who do you have in your ear coming from the timing stand? But the other part of it is your relationship between yourself and as the driver and your engineer. And that is, in my experience, at least, like that is ultimately the thing that dictates a lot of the vibe within a team. And even if it's not the voice that you're hearing during the race, and in some situations it is, right? Like sometimes the engineer is the one that's talking to you, or it's some combination of those things. But and it just feels to me like Joseph, you know, is a little bit more. I think last year with Eric coming from Pratt & Miller and that whole thing, it was they like needed to find a solution, and
it was quick as well.
Yeah, it was just they needed to find like a pretty quick solution, and they went hunting for talent. And Luke was on this squad last year. I think he was the performance engineer.
Yep.
Last year, but he was kind of new to the two crew, or maybe hadn't had, you know, maybe the team didn't feel like he quite had the experience, or whatever the reasons for it was, that wasn't really, you know, in the cards. And so, you know, it just felt like, I think, and again, from the outside, I don't have a lot of insight into exactly how the whole thing went down, but it just had the appearance of being like, this is kind of like a forced hand in terms of what we're going to do right now. And just from that perspective, it's immediately not ideal, right? And so in this scenario, you know, Joseph is working with a guy that's been on his timing stand that he feels really good about. And sometimes just personalities work better with somebody else. And sometimes that's, you know, in this case, I kind of get the feeling that Joseph and Luke are kind of similar in terms of their personalities and energy levels and those kinds of things. Some drivers do better with somebody who brings something to the table that's totally different than what they bring to the table. So it's not necessarily to say that, you know, the best driver engineer combinations are guys that like would be friends away from the track or something, but you do have to build something with that person that just gives you, you know, lets you be at the right number on the rev limiter when it counts, when you get in the car. And it just sort of feels like Joseph's got that in a way with Luke. You know, his tone, like the way that they sort of seem together, some of the body language that you see, it seems much more similar to the way that he was like when he was with Gavin Ward, and that they're just able to kind of create an energy between the two of them that meshes and vibes and isn't creating distraction. You're not having to like walk on eggshells. You're not having to do these things. And part of that is that he's just not brand new to Joseph and the two crew as well. So I guess I agree with you from the little bits and pieces that I kind of see just knowing Joseph. It definitely feels like he's feeling like they're in a better place for whatever reason that might be. And again, like it might just have nothing to do with, it might have nothing to do with skill or performance level or, you know, background or knowledge or whatever. It's just, you know, sometimes there's kind of a human component to the whole thing that does matter.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
DirecTV gives you access to apps like Netflix and live sports right next to each other.
I don't get it.
Let me put it in pigeon terms. It's like that one amazing dumpster with the old fruits and cardboard all in one place.
How am I supposed to keep up with illustrative metaphors when you are making me so hungry?
Get live TV and streaming apps together without a satellite. Visit DirecTV.com. Requires high-speed internet-connected Gemini device and separate paid subscription to watch Netflix on DirecTV. Terms and restrictions apply.
All right, JR, we're running out of time slightly towards the end of the pod, but I do want to run through some significant results through the Texas field, basically good and bad, unfortunately, I suppose, for the bad ones. But I guess we'll start with the medium, the good and the bad, Roman Grosjean, because he was running up front, you know, all day long there. I don't think anyone would disagree that that was his best oval race of his short IndyCar oval racing career so far. It definitely felt like he and his team have found something. And again, it's that understeer thing. It's the same problem that they've had on the road and street courses that they've been having on the ovals as well. And they found something at Iowa that Roman seemed to like last year. And it seems to have worked at Texas as well and kind of brought his car alive a little bit in the race. So he was happy with that. I spoke to him this morning while he was cleaning his plane. So that was good fun. I could hear the spritzing of his spray while he was cleaning the keel in the background as I was asking him serious questions about IndyCar. So that was good fun. He was definitely upset at the...
Life must not be too bad.
Yeah, I know. But he had forgot the keys for the inside of the plane. So he was going to have to go home and pick those up before he could clean the interior of the plane. So, you know, I did feel sorry for him at that point. I was ready to bring the violin out, but
violin.
Yeah, but he made some good humor out of it. So we'll let him off for that one. Yeah, I think he was pretty unlucky at the end of the race there, I thought. You know, obviously, anyone who's crashing out in that scenario has to take an element of responsibility, but he was certainly unfortunate in the sense that that was tight, close racing. It was difficult to judge the fact you were going to lose the air off the front of the car there and that was going to happen. I think, you know, maybe a more experienced oval racer at Texas sees that coming and backs out. Even, you know, Roman says he backs out. He did back out entering the corner because he was expecting, you know, something similar to happen. And you know, maybe even a veteran wouldn't have gotten out of that situation. It's a difficult one to kind of bounce back and forth. But he's definitely feeling a lot more confident about ovals now. And going into the 500, he's a little bit more excited about the prospect of that than he might have been before Texas and his performance there. So that was one I definitely wanted to pick out. There was a couple more as well, I think. Definitely worth mentioning Hungos Hollinger racing with Callum Ilott, who had two top 10s in the whole of 2022 and has opened the 2023 season with two top 10s with a ninth and his fifth at St. Pete, both of them qualifying well down the order. I think he was 17th in qualifying at Texas and he was 22nd at St. Pete. And I think that's an area where Callum has accepted and the team has accepted that qualifying is not necessarily going to be their strong suit this year, but they're going to, you know, come on a bit strong in races. And Agustin Canapino, we spoke to his engineer, Charlie Ping, on the show last week, unfortunately without you, JR, but we'll definitely get him back on for you to grill him about all matters tech when it comes to IndyCar. But he was talking about getting Agustin Canapino ready for his oval debut, and he was dizzy and almost unable to stand up once he'd got out of the car, which is probably not a surprise to you, JL, but maybe a surprise to some of the listeners at home who aren't maybe familiar with what it feels like to do your first race at Texas and be put in a washing machine at 220 miles an hour, basically, is kind of what happens. So I felt very sorry for him as I sat on the pit wall with him, and he was kind of just holding himself up on the pit wall, like almost as if he was doing some sort of like some sort of dip or something on the pit.
We've all been there, buddy.
Yeah. I felt very sorry for him, but he said he'd never felt anything like that in his life before. But two 12th place finishes to start the year, and we've had 27 cars in the first race and 28 cars in the second race. I'm sure. Well, I don't think anyone would have predicted that at the start of the season, and he's definitely proven himself to be every bit the champion that he showed he was in Argentina. David Baloukas as well, shout out to him. He's actually ahead of Callum Ilott in the points. Had another strong race there. I think he probably didn't have anything for Joseph and Pato, if we're being honest, at the end of the race. But I think, you know, he deserved to be in the top five. He did a good job to be there, and he's proven himself on ovals as well. That he's definitely got something there, and that he's developing very, very nicely with Dale Coyne. Seems to have added a level of consistency that team doesn't really seem to get as well. You know, we know Coyne as that team who's, you know, it's capable of scoring wild results on its day, but struggles for that consistent element of being able to do that week in, week out. Whereas, you know, David, you know, maybe hasn't had that win yet, or that pole, or maybe that, you know, that kind of your name in bright shining lights above the movie theater moment, but he's definitely, you know, he's definitely proven himself a future IndyCar star, in my opinion.
Yeah, and I think it's also worth just noting that last year he had a veteran in Takuma Sato alongside him for the entire year. This year he just doesn't. I mean, he's the veteran of these two guys kind of leading the charge. So, you know, without a technical relationship with another team, without any of those things, you know, I mean, for him to be notching top five results anywhere in any set of conditions is, in my mind, super impressive and definitely deserving of a shout out.
Yeah, it feels like he doesn't really get the credit he deserves. He's not really talked about as much as maybe, you know, people should. And maybe that's because he hasn't necessarily had those standout performances, or because he doesn't come from Formula One, or any of those reasons, basically. But I know for a fact that he's very highly admired by a lot of the team bosses in the paddock, and people inside the paddock are definitely paying a lot of attention to David Malukas. I guess we should also mention Rahal Letterman-Lanigan, who were 18th and 19th with Jack Harvey and Christine Lungard. Just seems like a bit of a mess over there at the minute, to be honest. It's really sad to see. Obviously, we had this, you know, big reset in the off-season with a load of you know, new engineers coming in. You know, Bobby Rahal obviously back in the team with added people and trying to give the team more resource, and it's definitely not paid off to start the season. They really struggled through, you know, practice and qualifying at St. Pete. And, you know, I think it was some really wise racecraft in a very attrition-filled race at St. Pete that was a typical Graham Rahal performance, wasn't it, really? He was cool, calm, confident and quick when others around him were faltering and not able to match that. And Christian Lungard seems to have that same kind of ability to do the similar kind of thing. He's one of these people who's just, wherever he qualifies, in a, you know, I don't want to say in a Dixon-like manner, because that is the you're reserving that praise for the very highest honour. But he do, you know, both of those guys, Graham Rahal and Christian Lungard, seem to be able to qualify low down and still, you know, produce top tens and big results. But yeah, they've definitely struggled to start the year, and Graham unfortunately taken out in a bit of an incident that wasn't his fault really with Devlin DeFrancesco. But I still don't know if they were going to be able to crack the top 15 at the end of the race, or if that was going to be, you know, possible. They just struggled with so much understeer. You could just see, like, watching the qualifying laps, you know, Jack Harvey especially, like, such big lifts in the corners and just really, really struggling. So yeah, I think we'll be hoping that they're able to turn it around, and Long Beach at least might, you know, be a good opportunity, given that they've had St. Pete, they've had a street course race under their belt. But still, I think there's a lot of work to do there this season for that team.
Yeah, I think Graham's hurting for there being somebody else on the team that he can lean on to establish some. I mean, not that he doesn't know what he needs to look for at these kinds of places, but in this type of situation, having somebody else there who can bounce things off of and kind of just know that when you're trying something, you can trust the feedback outside of just, you know, it's one thing when you, you know, jam a setup on Christian's car or Jack's car and they just immediately go way faster. That's easy to know that that's, you know, you're heading in the right direction, but sometimes it's not that it takes like five or six changes to kind of get to the point that that's where you're at. And on these ovals, if you're not confident and comfortable in the car, of these three guys, Graham is certainly the one that can just put up with that probably and deal with it, because he's driven enough miles at these kinds of places in cars that just for everybody were not that confidence inspiring. So he's got that bit of experience under his belt. To your point, it seems like Christian has a bit of that just, okay, I can just sit here and grind this out, like a little under the limit, but I can be kind of right up against where the limit is. I can keep the car right there for a lot of the lap. You know, Jack still seems like he's just kind of having a hard time finding the feeling that he's looking for in the car, and that after not having that for quite a while now, it seems like, you know, more or less his sort of tenure at Rahal. Also coming back to a track that he had a big accident last year, that doesn't help. So it's, I never kind of question how much of a factor guys' confidence is or something. Like, I think all of these guys are capable of being extremely confident drivers and assertive and knowing what they're looking for. And it's not like you're chasing a ghost, but, you know, there's no question that in order to really get back to operating at a high level, sometimes you just need for things to sort of be right, so you can refamiliarize yourself with what that feels like. And without that now on an oval, for these guys, that really, that's tough. I mean, that's, you know, for looking ahead to Indy, you know, they've got to right that part of the ship here in a hurry, you know, like almost, I think almost treat it like you're starting from scratch and do whatever you got to do to establish a confidence in the car and a confidence in the feeling of the rear of the car. And if that means you're dealing with understeer for the first couple of days at the speedway or whatever, like, so be it. But at least, you know, at least get things back to a baseline where everybody agrees on what's going on, at least, because, you know, as Graham said in his interview, after getting taken out or whatever, being in that crash, you can tell that where he finished or where he was running was totally unimportant to him at that point. He was just sort of baffled by the performance that they had over the course of that weekend and that they couldn't really get it figured out. So definitely something to look for as we head into the month of May as the next big oval.
If you are a Rahal Letterman Lanigan fan currently punching your iPod or something at the level of criticism that you're listening to here, I guess you can take solace in the fact that they had that test at Sebring last year, sort of just after halfway through the year, I think that was, where they were able to find some things and did exactly what you just suggested, really, was went back to basics. They threw on some dampers from like 2008 or 9 or something to get a read on like where they'd come from and where they'd ended up and how that had happened, and really just gone, you know, right back to basics to try and find that problem. So what you've just suggested, JR, is, you know, they've got prior for that very recently, and it's, you know, put them in good stead. So while it's very rare for one test to change a whole team's IndyCar season, it does occasionally happen, and we know Rahal can be really good at 500, so I'm sure that'll be their immediate focus heading into that. We'll wrap Texas up there, JR. It was definitely a barnstorming race. It was lovely to go there and see Texas for the first time. I really enjoyed it. I'm sad that you weren't able to race there, but I'm sure we'll see you back in an IndyCar at some point in the near future. Near can be defined by, well, you can define near and tell us when near is, but the fans are,
sorry, do you know something I don't know,
cliffhanger,
man?
There left on a cliffhanger there as to when the near future is going to be, but we're all hoping that it's going to be soon.
Well, me too, Jack. I appreciate that.
Make sure you check out the-race.com for all your latest news, features, and reports from Texas in IndyCar and for all of the other championships that you cover, like MotoGP, Formula One, and Formula E, for example. Definitely worth checking all of those series out, but especially IndyCar, because I write about IndyCar and I'm the best, so you should go and check it out. That's all for this week's episode of the Race IndyCar Podcast, and we'll be back soon before Long Beach to preview that one. We'll see you then.
The Athletic.